is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Ukraine and the Russian takeover of Ukraine's Crimea region is the number one topic on President Obama's agenda as he meets with other world leaders in the Netherlands. The president is in Europe for a G7 summit, a group of the world's biggest industrialized economies and normally dubbed the G8, but this time Russia, for obvious reasons, was excluded. At the meeting, President Obama called for increased economic and political sanctions against Russia. It's an approach members of Congress support, including New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte, who also called for tougher sanctions against the Putin government. Ayotte spoke on CBS's Face the Nation over the weekend while on a trip to Ukraine.
We need him to understand that the sanctions that we put in place could have a significant impact on his economy, that we need to deter further action from him and understand who he is. Former KGB colonel, he's a bully, and bullies only understand when we punch them in the nose, but we need to do that economically. That is our strongest move at this point.
Today on The Exchange, a panel of Granite Staters with ties to Ukraine is with us on these latest developments, and let's hear from you. If you have family or friends in Ukraine, what are you hearing from them? And what's going through your mind as this situation gets more tense? What do you think the U.S. response should be? What about the Europeans? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. With me in studio is Al Baymar, a software engineer in Nashua. He's been in New Hampshire since the late 1990s. He's originally from eastern Ukraine. And Al Baymar, welcome back. It's good to see you.
Nice to be back here, Laura.
Joining us from Hanover, Yulia Komska, assistant professor of German at Dartmouth College, originally from western Ukraine. Her first book, The Icon Curtain, The Cold War's Quiet Border, will be released in December of this year. And Yulia Komska, welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us from Ukraine is Laurent Marshall, former member of the Peace Corps in Ukraine. He now lives and works in the city of Lviv in the West. Laurent grew up in New Hampshire. He's a graduate of Sauhegan High School. And Laurent Marshall, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, Laurent, you're on the ground. First of all, just tell us how this increasing tension over the annexation of Crimea, concerns about what Russia might do next, how is this affecting daily life there, Laurent?
Well, so far, like the last couple of weeks, it hasn't had much of a huge effect on daily life. People are obviously really worried, and the atmosphere is really tense, but we haven't really seen any serious changes just in how people live day to day, really, at least in western Ukraine. I think the situation's different in eastern Ukraine, for sure, and
sure.
Especially in Crimea.
Sure, because Crimea, again, is the part that Russia annexed in eastern Ukraine. You said people are worried, Laurent. What are they worried about?
Well, they're really worried about what Putin will do next, because he's taken over Crimea on the pretext that he's defending Russian citizens or Russian compatriots, which is, the basis for this argument is pretty broad, and it could apply to the rest of Ukraine, as well as other countries even, if you think about Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, the other Baltic states, Belarus, and even Kazakhstan.
How does your wife and wife's family feel about this, Laurent? You're married to a Ukrainian.
Yeah. It's really worrying. People here are very conscious of all the history, going back to the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, and repression, targeted against Ukrainians, and that memory is still very much alive here in western Ukraine. A lot of people, I think most families here, have experienced that repression, especially following World War II and the Stalin years, with deportations to Siberia.
Wow. I can see why they're worried.
Yeah.
How do people feel, Laurent, about the fact that so far Ukrainian forces have let the Russians take over in Crimea? They're withdrawing without a fight.
Well, yeah, I think people are mostly, it's pretty obvious that this is not an equal fight, and there's not really a whole lot the Russian armed forces can do. I think people are a little bit, they're pretty frustrated that the Ukrainian Defense Ministry hasn't been more decisive in extracting troops from Crimea. Also, it was a bit confusing as to whether they would allow their Ukrainian troops in Crimea to use force or not. So it's a bit frustrating to watch the situation, but I think for the most part, people understand that this is sort of a kind of militarily a no-win situation.
It's hard to take up arms against Russia, given the size differences.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and Yulia and Al, we talked less than a month ago about this rising tension. And Yulia, to you, now Russia has annexed Crimea through this questionable vote. What's going through your mind, Yulia, these days about this rapidly changing situation?
Well, a lot of different things. First of all, what's going to happen to people in Crimea? Is Russia going to be able to integrate Crimea, absorb it economically? There is supposed to be a financial aid package that Russia is sending to Crimea, the subsidies. And, of course, there are a lot of provinces in Russia itself that are competing for the same money, so there is some discontent about that. Then, of course, Crimea gets its water and power supply from Ukraine because that's just how the power lines are set, and the question is whether Ukraine cut off the supply to Crimea now that it's annexed by Russia or not. So far, the forecast is that it won't, just because there are Crimean Tatars living in Crimea who have sided with Ukraine, and there is also Ukrainian minority, you could say, living there as well. So Ukraine wouldn't want to jeopardize its own nationals.
So
living there.
Yeah. So Crimea isn't, even though that vote was depicted as, you know, this is terrific, we want to be with Russia, welcome us back with open arms. It sounds like, Yulia, there are lots of folks in Crimea who are not thrilled with this.
There are. And there are a lot of folks who didn't turn up to vote, actually. Only about 30% of Tatars attended the referendum on March 16th. And Ukrainian numbers were probably about as low as that as well. So the 96% of the votes cast in favor of joining Russia, they were also cast by people who are predominantly Russian speakers. Some of them already had Russian passports. Some of them had very close ties to Russia, Crimea. 77% of Crimeans have had very close ties to Russia. They've had relatives, they've had economic connections and so forth. So they were the ones to predominantly show up at the polls on the 16th.
Yeah, and Al, I want to go to you too. First of all, what's going through your mind right now as you read these headlines? And what are you hearing from family and friends in Ukraine, Al?
Well, what I hear from my friends and family over there is that they're sad, they're angry. Well, Laura, how would you feel if Russia decided to annex Alaska? That's pretty much what they're feeling over there.
I saw a cartoon, actually, with that joke that Putin taking Russia back. Yeah, go ahead,
right,
Al.
So that's a part of the story. And the other part of the story is, of course, the folks there, and especially in the eastern part of Ukraine, they're really worried about the possible invasion of Russia into the southern eastern part of Ukraine. From what I hear, there's a large concentration of Russian troops, which is as much as about 100,000 troops on the border. Obviously, the amount of troops like that is unlikely to be there for no reason. So it's either they're going to dismiss quite soon or there's going to be some kind of an invasion.
Wow. So kind of what Laurent said, people are worried. They're still upset about Crimea, and they're worried about whether Russia wants to gobble up something else.
Absolutely. And it's not that they're just upset about Crimea. They're frustrated because, well, an analogy which comes to my mind is, let's say that you, God forbid, have just had a surgery, and you're still recovering, and now your neighbor shows up at the hospital and he says, you know, that garage that my dad gave you as a present 20 years ago, I think it's mine now. So I'm going to take back the garage. I'm going to break the lock. And by the way, whatever I find in that garage is mine, too.
I want to invite our listeners to join us. And then so many more questions for all of you. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there. Robin's joining us from Keene. Hi, Robin. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. So I've just returned from Ukraine, a Peace Corps volunteer as well. Hello, Laurent. Hello? And we were evacuated on February 23rd. I was serving for 1 year at this point in central Ukraine at a town called Gadich, and I was surprised to find out that people there really don't feel comfortable or free to speak out. So while we saw the protests in Kiev, in a much more sophisticated area of the country, people in the outer regions, you know, fear retaliation if they voice their sentiments. And the other part is people aren't used to protests. They aren't used to organizing. So when we hear these voices from Ukraine, we have to be careful that there is a lot of silence not stating their opinion that really need the support of the West.
So, Robin, you were with the Peace Corps in Ukraine. What part of the country again, please?
It's central Ukraine, but we were on the very eastern side of the central region.
Okay. And what did the – was it the State Department that said you need to be evacuated?
The Peace Corps consulted with the U.S. Embassy and made that decision.
Sure.
And rightfully so. I mean, my town now has soldiers from Lviv that were sent guarding either side of the highway because they fear just what your guest said, that the Russians are going to come into eastern Ukraine.
What was the language that was used, Robin, when they said, look, sorry, we know you're trying to do good work there, but you got to go?
Pretty much just what you said was the language. You know, for our safety, the State Department and the Peace Corps has 5 security points, and none of them could be met reasonably. So they decided it was time to evacuate Peace Corps volunteers.
Wow. Well, Robin, welcome back home. Sorry under its not such great circumstances.
Yeah. But I would like the people to remember that there isn't a lot of freedom right now in Ukraine, at least for people in the east and the central region. So their voices aren't being heard, and they desperately, I think, need our support.
Robin, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, Laura.
Yulia, I love your quick thoughts there. What do you make of the fact that the situation is so unstable that they're evacuating Peace Corps volunteers?
Well, it's fascinating to hear that, and it's in line with what I've heard on the news as well in terms of the accumulation of troops that Al's already mentioned. And also in terms of the people sent to Russia, by Russia to those areas that creates the circumstances for speech being less free.
All right. A lot more to talk about in just a moment. More conversation with our panel of Granite Staters who have close ties to Ukraine. We're taking your thoughts, too, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Tables are running out for NHPR's second annual Trivia Smackdown. Sign up your team and brush up on your trivia. You could be this year's champ on April 18th, but first, you have to enter at nhpr.org. This event made possible in part by Lincoln Financial Group. More of our update on the Ukraine on the Exchange and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the global rise in drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny today, highs from mid-20s north, ranging mid-30s in the south. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, now offering electrical repair and service in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters, online at justcallheritage.com. And Waldorf Schools of Southern New Hampshire, including Monadnock Waldorf School, Keene, offering public programs for parents in March. Information at monadnockwaldorfschool.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, an update on Ukraine with a panel of Granite Staters who have strong ties to the country. We invite you to join us with your questions and comments. If you have family or friends in Ukraine, what are you hearing from them? What's going through your mind as the situation gets more tense? Also, what do you think the U.S. response should be to this situation? What about the Europeans? Give us a call. We'd love to hear what you think. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Yulia Komska. She's a professor at Dartmouth College, originally from Western Ukraine. Al Baymar is with us. He's a software manager in Nashua. He's from Eastern Ukraine. And Laurent Marshall joins us from the country. He used to work for the Peace Corps. He now lives and works in Lviv in Western Ukraine. And Laurent, I'd love to hear from you too. I was really struck by Robin and Keen, who called, current Peace Corps volunteer, was sent home because Peace Corps determined that it wasn't that safe. What do you think?
Well, yeah. So I finished up actually my service with Peace Corps back in January this year. pretty much right after I finished up, things got pretty bad in Kyiv, with a really violent response from Yanukovych's government. That was the former president, and that was a really scary situation, especially around February 18th to the 22nd, when police and internal military troops in Kyiv were shooting demonstrators. There were, you know, riots every night. And so, I mean, it makes a lot of sense that Peace Corps pulled out the volunteers. So I think they were all pulled out, I think, by February 25th.
Wow. And you are staying there because, again, you're married, you've got a job,
yeah.
You're staying there.
Yeah. Regular life.
Yeah. What are you hearing from your friends and family in New Hampshire, Laurent? Are they saying, hey, Laurent?
Well, yeah, I think people are a little worried about me. But the thing I keep telling people is that, you know, Ukraine is a really big country. If you imagine Texas and just stretch it out a little bit longer, squish it vertically, stretch it out. So, you know, if I'm in Lviv here, everything that's happening in Crimea and in eastern Ukraine is really hundreds and hundreds of miles away. So here where I am, everything is pretty normal, really. So.
You know, Al, I wanted to ask you and ask everybody, but I'll start with you, Al. What you, as a Ukrainian, what your friends and family in Ukraine want the U.S. to do? There's been a lot of talk about what the U.S. response should be to this Crimea situation.
Right. Most of them want the U.S. to act much stronger than it does now. We all know that there are some sanctions in place, and there were two stages of those sanctions, and most likely there is going to be one more, which might or might not have a contingency of the further invasion of the Russian troops into Ukraine. Now, what comes to my mind is that instead of going stage by stage, and again, I'm not a politician, I'm with IT. It's definitely not my business, but if it were up to me, I would act much stronger. Why? Because to me, it's something like an antibiotics course. When you want to fight a harmful bacteria, you don't go by taking one pill and then trying to feel if you're feeling any better, and then maybe taking one more and one more. No, instead of that, you would just go to the full extent to make sure that you fix the situation. So if it were up to me, I would act much boldly with closing borders, seizing bank transactions, arresting government assets, imposing embargo on gas. Yes, it's going to hurt everyone to a degree, right? But we are facing a really major international threat here.
Well, embargoes of oil and gas, the U.S., that's not such a big deal for the United States, right? We make a lot of our own energy. We get a lot from Canada, Venezuela. So for us, that's not such a hardship. For the Europeans, Al, as you know,
that's why a hardship. European position has been much, much softer, unfortunately.
Are you disappointed in that?
Well, we're on the air, so I have to be polite about my response.
Yulia, I love your thoughts as well. The U.S., I mean, both as a professor, but also as just a person from Ukraine, what do you want the U.S. to do?
Well, I think I would tend to agree with Al that it would be good to get sanctions that are broader than the ones pertaining to just some select politicians. And it also would be good to do the kinds of measures that Visa and MasterCard, for instance, implemented, not letting the Russian banks use their system. Of course, Russia is responding by talking about initiating its own electronic banking systems within the country. So I don't know how immune it would be against some of these sanctions. And I think that working together with Europeans is very important. And I'm not entirely sure that Europe's bailed out or is as hands-off as it has been, or can afford to be as hands-off as it has been in the last couple of months, because it's just signed an association agreement with Ukraine. The political side of it, the economic side, will be signed after the elections on May 25th, provided they go well. And the political provisions is basically what it is an array of mutual promises. What the EU will do for Ukraine and what Ukraine will do to coordinate its political system and its the way its economy is run with the principles of the EU. And one of the clauses there is that the EU will uphold territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. So in case Russia does do something crazy with all those troops accumulated at the border there, the EU won't just be able to stand by. And I think the EU is also looking at much more radical re-envisioning of its energy consumption, turning to alternative energy sources, stockpiling gas from other places, rerouting gas supply from different areas. So I think it's not just about what the U.S. can do, but what the transatlantic alliance that's been hurting in the last year and has just been patched up by responses to the Ukraine crisis recently, what the transatlantic alliance can accomplish together.
So, Yulia, are you satisfied or not satisfied so far with what the U.S. has done in particular? We can talk more about the Europeans in a minute. What do you think? They're talking about broadening these sanctions.
I'm satisfied with the fact that there's been no war so far, and I think that most people appreciate that. With the economic side, I think I'm less satisfied with that. I'm also less satisfied with how the U.S. has been wrangling about passing not just the sanctions, but also the economic aid package. There have been differences between the Democrats and the Republicans in both the Senate, to the lesser extent. It actually passed the Senate yesterday, but also in the House. And I think that there could be some more bipartisanship about the extent of financial aid to Ukraine, whether it would go through the International Monetary Fund, that's the big stone of contention, or come directly from the U.S.
Well, I also want to hear from our listeners about what they might like to see the U.S. do, the Europeans do, in response to this situation in Ukraine. You can join us with your thoughts, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Here's an email that just came in from Robin, who says, one major problem is the face-off against Russia is that the U.S., NATO, Ukraine, and the G7 are largely deliberating in public, so Putin gets to make his moves with far less uncertainty than ought to be. He says the G7 participants tend to announce these sanctions or those sanctions will be implemented in case Putin does this or that. A former NATO commander on NPR this morning was saying armed resistance is off the table. Our emailer says, all clear, Mr. Putin. He says, with all these strategy blabbermouths, Putin can closely calibrate just how far he can go and at what speed, depending on what consequences he chooses to accept or feels he can counter. We have to worry about his intentions, but he has no worry about ours. Al, what do you think? And then I want to hear from you too, Laurent, but go ahead, Al.
I couldn't agree more. Our international policy has been notoriously bad whenever we have to deal with regimes which are different from our Western values. And what seems to be a pattern is we seem to be falling behind the real updates on the ground. And a great example of that is the famous or maybe infamous leak of the conversation between Victoria Nuland and Ambassador to Ukraine Jeffrey Pyatt. It was famous for its reference to the EU, but it's not about that. It's about the fact that the content of that discussion was showing how behind of the real situation our State Department was. They were discussing putting the Prime Minister, which would satisfy the U.S., Arseniy Yatsenyuk, into the government of Viktor Yanukovych just a few days before the whole regime went down.
So we didn't even realize how close that government
was.
We
keep getting behind, and meanwhile, we allow Putin plan his strategy maybe five steps ahead, and that's the problem.
Just like our emailer says. Yeah, what do you think about that, Laurent, that the U.S. constantly underestimates and, as Al says, doesn't understand really what is going on over there?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at U.S. and Western policy towards Russia, over the last 20 years, there's been a lot of wishful thinking. And unfortunately, I think often we haven't fully understood the extent to the corruption in Russia, the corruption in the court system, in the police, sort of just how authoritarian really the political system in Russia is. And I think, as Robin was mentioning in her email, this kind of is an issue because, well, Putin doesn't have any accountability. He doesn't have any responsibility to transparency. And he, I think, strategically does exploit this sort of to keep everyone on the edge of their seats. So, from our side, it looks like this brinksmanship, what's he going to do next? He has a plan, but of course he doesn't have to tell anyone about it or debate it in public with anyone.
Well, there's some talk this morning, Yulia, about Russia now eyeing a section of Moldova, that this isn't over with Crimea. What do you think?
Well, it's also not just Russia eyeing a section of Moldova, but a section of Moldova, Transnistria specifically, as it's called, eyeing being annexed to Russia. And that's nothing new. That's been a kind of a secessionist part of the world for a very long time, since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I'm not sure. I mean, there is a concept in Russia of the near abroad, of the adjacent countries with significant post-Soviet Russian minorities, and whether they would legally be annexable to Russia or not, even though their territories do not border on Russia, as is the case in Transnistria. I'm not honestly sure where that will go, because the fact is that the Crimea's annexation has also spawned a wide range of secessionist movements everywhere. There is a referendum in Scotland to be held. There is now an electronic petition complete in the Italian province of Veneto, which wants now to secede from Russia. So who knows to what extent these secessionist areas will have legitimacy. Plus, in the case of Transnistria, there would have to be a national referendum conducted according to the laws of Moldova, in which Transnistria is part, and I honestly don't see the laws of Moldova jiving very well with a referendum of this sort.
You know what I'm struck by, Yulia, and maybe you too, Al? Just the idea, Yulia, that, you know, I thought, from an American perspective, and you know, some of you have said the American perspective has perhaps been a bit naive. But, Yulia, you know, you look at this and you think, hey, didn't we settle this? I mean, after the Iron Curtain fell and the Soviet Union disintegrated and many parts of the former Soviet Empire were made distinct countries and everybody promised to keep it that way. And Ukraine even signed away its nuclear weapons because under a promise of security from the U.S. and Britain and Russia. So looking at this from a purely American perspective, you know, we look over there to Eastern Europe and say, hey, we settled this already. You know, why is this happening again?
Well, I think I'm not even sure that it's particular to the region. If you look at the map of the entire world, there are very few countries that don't have any kind of territorial disputes that are ongoing or have been ongoing for decades, and some of them for centuries, actually. And Mongolia, for instance, is one of the few places that's not disputing its territories with anybody. But if you look at the map of the world, neither Transnistria nor Crimea nor any other region seems unique. So I think that we also need to look at the larger picture of it, and see that this is just, it's 19th century still, but in some sense that 19th century geopolitical stuff of people capturing places, people disputing borders, that's still ongoing in the 21st century.
Wow. What do you think, Al?
Well, just wanted to add two more comments. For Transnistria, yes, indeed, there would be a need for the national referendum to let them go, but if you take a look at the law of Ukraine, you would find the same. To let Crimea go, you would need to hold a national referendum. Did it help them? Apparently not.
Well, and the referendum was questioned.
They had their local referendum with 96% voting in favor of Russia. How credible is that? I'm not really sure. All I know is that historically the record of transparency of any votes conducted by Russia or in Russia were really bad.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions and comments for our panel, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. As the situation in Ukraine gets more tense, what do you think the U.S. response should be? What do you think the European response should be? And if you yourself have ties to Ukraine, like our guests, what are you hearing from family and friends in that country? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And all of you, here's an email from Christopher in Manchester who says, I recently read an article in the Boston Globe about the sizable Jewish population in Ukraine. What do they have to fear with a Russian crackdown? And similarly, do the Tatars in Crimea face repression and expulsion now? Good question, Christopher. Laurent, I don't know if you know anything about this.
Sure. As to the Jewish community in Ukraine, I don't know a whole lot about it. I know there were some statements from one of the main rabbis in Kyiv, because there's a lot of Russian propaganda about fascism in Ukraine. They keep on saying that this was a fascist coup, and I think the rabbi in Kyiv actually stood up to refute this. But as far as that, I don't know a whole lot if they would face repression in the case of a Russian invasion or not.
Well, it's an interesting point. Yeah, a point well taken. And he's right, Yulia. Repression of Jews was one of the excuses that Putin made for, you know, protecting Russians in Crimea. Go ahead, Yulia, your thoughts on Christopher's email. And Christopher, thank you.
I'm not so sure that Jews were so much on Putin's agenda when he walked in Crimea. And I'm also not entirely sure how big Jewish population is in Russia. It is, however, I think Christopher's point is very well taken. There's been a bill debated or put to the floor in the Duma, the Russian National Assembly, about reintroducing the nationality paragraph in the Russian passports, basically a part of the passport that used to be there during the Soviet Union and was then dispensed with in the early 90s that would tell everybody which nationality you are. And that basically means not that you're a Russian national, but it means ethnicity. That's a Russian word or a Russian way of saying what ethnic category you belong to. And of course, in Russia, that was a very sure way to, in the Soviet Union, that was a very sure way to discriminate against people, especially against people who were not among the major populations, Jews and Tatars among them.
Yeah. So
I think that could be dangerous. It was proposed by the Communist Party, and it's not sure whether that bill will pass, and if so, when. And I think the same can be said for the Tatars. Some of them have already been asked to free the land on which they are right now.
All right. Well, Christopher, again, thank you for the email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. More conversation on the situation in Ukraine from a New Hampshire perspective in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the global rise in drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis. Then a Nigerian-American author on writing fiction and experimenting with photography and social media. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Merrimack County Savings Bank, helping the community thrive for over 145 years with 7 full-service branches in Bow, Kentucky, Concord, and Nashua, themerrimack.com. And Landmark College Putney, Vermont, offering a summer institute for education professionals, working with students who learn differently. June 24th to the 27th. Information at landmark.edu. 940, this is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, the ongoing battle over wind power in the Granite State. Today in The Exchange, our update on the crisis in Ukraine with a panel of New Hampshire people who have strong ties to that country. Join us now with your questions or comments. If you have ties to Ukraine, we'd love to hear from you. What's going through your mind right now? What you're hearing from family or friends in the country? Also, what you think the U.S. response should be to this situation? The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. all one word. All of you, we've talked a lot about the U.S. response, and all of you talked about sanctions and so forth. Some in Congress have talked about not military action, but strengthening Ukraine's military. Al, what do you think? I mean, how much would that really help, given the enormous size differences that we've talked about between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, for one thing, what makes me a little bit surprised is this. Why both the U.S. and the EU need to underscore they would not have any military engagement? Why to make this public? If you take a look at what Putin does, it's a black box. You don't know anything before it happens. Why do we act as a white box and providing all the benefits of knowing what our plans are, again, to make their own plans 5 steps ahead? As for the help with the weapons, yeah, sure, that would be fantastic. What else could I say in response?
You know, it's interesting, as we look at this, Yulia, that some people would say economic sanctions only, but some in Congress are talking about beefing up Ukraine's military. Your thoughts, Yulia, and then I have another question for you, Laurent.
Mm-hmm. I don't think that they are talking about putting more boots on the ground.
But no.
I do think that they're talking about shipping weapons and specifically more hawkish, as it were, Republican politicians. I think that as a deterrent, it would probably work some, although the truth remains that we are also talking about Russia, which is the largest nuclear power in the world. So I'm not entirely sure that amassing vast reserves of conventional weapons would really be of tremendous help, given that there are also huge differences in terms of the men available to both Russia and Ukraine to fight. Russia's military, without the active military, is almost 1 million people, and Ukraine's is about 130,000 people. So who's gonna man the weapons,
yeah,
too? That's also the question. There's been National Guard created in Ukraine, about 20,000 people by a law, I think, passed last week, and there has been no shortage of volunteers. But I think the manpower also remains a big question for me.
Yeah, and we talked earlier about tougher economic sanctions, and everybody in the U.S. at least seems to be on board with that. But from what I understand, Laurent, there are strong, strong economic ties between Russia and Ukraine. So would a toughening up on Russia economically also hit Ukraine economically?
Well, I think that's sort of a non-issue, because Russia has pretty much already, and even if you look back even this summer, they were basically sanctioning Ukraine economically. So earlier this fall, one of Ukraine's oligarchs, Poroshenko, he owns a chocolate company, and he made some comments pointed against Russia, and Russia found a reason to block imports of Ukrainian chocolates. And so my understanding is that Russia has been using the economic dependency as a way to punish Ukraine, as a way to intimidate Ukraine into fulfilling Russia's requirements.
Let's take another call if we could. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Tony's calling in from Sutton. Hi, Tony, you're on the air. Welcome.
How are you?
Good, go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering, we had a debate when the debates were on between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney suggested that our biggest international concern was Russia, and Obama laughed it off. And I think this whole the whole situation here is a result of Obama leading from behind. He basically opened the door for all of this, because let's be real, Putin realizes that he's not going to do anything. I mean, other than sanctions, there's nothing going to happen.
Tony, thank you for the call. Yulia, there has been some critique of the president. He should have seen this coming. He's been too soft. What do you think?
Yes, I'm not so sure that, I mean, there's been a lot of critique of Obama's reset policy with Russia and how short-sighted it was, and that he should be the one to blame for the escalation around Crimea and Russia's sort of anything goes kind of policy. But I'm not entirely sure what a Republican president would have done differently. given the fact that there has been a huge push for diplomacy. And there is also a comparable critique of Putin inside Russia. There are also people coming out inside Russia, former administration advisors, and saying, look, Putin's picking the wrong fight. He should be concerned about Islamic countries. He should be concerned about China. And as we've seen, China has condemned Russia's annexation of Crimea because it's worried about its own territorial integrity, about its relations with Taiwan, especially, that's out there protesting as we speak. So I think that the blame is easy to place, and I would be very careful to do that.
Okay. Well, Tony, thank you for the call. And another question for you, Laurent. You know, we've been talking a lot about Putin and criticizing what he's doing and talking about the nervousness that we're not sure what he's going to do next. What about the new Ukrainian government, Laurent? I mean, are they kind of off the hook because they're so new, or are they playing a role in all this fear and uncertainty?
Well, I think one of the important things to remember is that the current Ukrainian government, it's still basically all the same people that were in parliament, in the Ukrainian parliament before. There haven't been elections yet. Yanukovych's party pretty much fell apart, but it's really still mostly the same people. And, you know, they've been, I think they're mostly was the, now we have the opposition parties in power. And I think they're sort of doing their best, but people are still not entirely satisfied with what they're seeing from the new government in Kyiv.
Yeah, and that's an important point, isn't it, Laurent, that at least from our perspective here, it seems like, oh, these are the good guys, they kicked out the bad guy, so we're all happy with the new Ukrainian government. You're saying some of the same cast of characters is still there in power?
Yeah, not so quick, because if you look at, Yulia Tymoshenko, the former prime minister who was released from prison after Yanukovych fled the country, a lot of these politicians that we still have here, they sort of came from the same sort of environment as Yanukovych, from, you know, the 1990s and this really corrupt business environment that Ukraine had at that time. And so they've amassed fortunes. And of course, in the past, they've committed crimes, many of them. You know, I think we still need elections in Ukraine. The question is whether, to what extent Russia will allow that to happen, honestly,
wow,
without interference.
So what do you think, Al? The new government isn't as pure as the driven snow.
No, not at all. And indeed, a lot of those people were, which were with the old government, involved into the old government, known for their corruption even, they're still a part of the new interim government, which to many people is very unpopular, especially after them having handled the whole crisis with Crimea really poorly and not providing a real good policy of how exactly Ukraine should have behaved there, because with the whole invasion, what Ukrainian military logically should have done, they should have either they should have been protecting the land, or they should have evacuated with an honor. And in reality, they didn't do either of those. They were somewhere in the middle, not picking up the fight, but not doing anything other in particular, because they were waiting for any clear orders from Kyiv, and there were none.
So we've had a lot of critique this hour of Putin. We've had some critique of Obama and the West. But you're saying, Al, the Ukrainian government, new as it may be, also bears some responsibility for things getting out of control.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just today or yesterday, finally, the defense minister has resigned.
Let's take another call. This is Amy waiting in Concord. Hi, Amy. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Thank you. Perhaps this information is not relevant to today, but I think it is. And it has to do with your recent comments in the last few minutes about whether the Jews were in any danger from Russians taking over the Ukraine.
Yes, we had an email from Christopher who asked about that. Go ahead, Amy.
I think it's very unlikely. If anyone knows the history of the Ukraine in the last 100 years, they will remember and know that when the Germans marched into the Ukraine in September 1941, they were greeted with flowers
and with cheers and with great ecstasy by the Ukrainians. And within 3 weeks, 33,000 Jews were slaughtered by the Germans and the Ukrainians in a place called Babi Yar, B-A-B-I-Y-A-R. Look it up on Google.
I'm familiar with it, yes.
33,000. I am appalled that one of your commenters had no knowledge of this history.
So you're saying, Amy...
Within the next 6 months, 2 years, while the Germans were still in the Ukraine, another 60,000 civilians and Jews and Russians were murdered by the Ukrainians. I don't think the Jews have anything to fear from the Russians, if there are any Jews even left in the Ukraine.
So wait, you're saying, Amy, that Jews in Ukraine should be nervous about the Russians, or they should not be nervous?
They should not be nervous about the Russians. They should be nervous about the Ukrainians.
Wow.
Now, as I say, this may have nothing to do with today's situation, but I want to clarify this point, that the Ukrainians are not saints and shouldn't be treated as saints.
Okay.
It's amazing how short our memories are about who's done what in this region.
Amy, thank you so much for your call. Yulia, do you want to comment?
Oh, absolutely. I think Amy's point deserves a clarification and is definitely deserves to be on the table out there. I think I didn't bring it up in the previous question because it pertained to Russia specifically. I myself is half Jewish and some of my family perished at Babi Yar, so that history is not at all strange or new or forgotten to me. And I think Russia's been really pushing the theory that Jews, Ukrainian Jews, are in danger in the hands of Ukrainian fascists who are running around in the streets. However, the point is that in terms of potential presidential candidates, the ultra-right party candidates only have 2.5% and 1.6% approval ratings. So I think... Laurent has already mentioned that Ukrainian Jews have stepped out and said that the West worries about them a lot more than they worry about themselves. I've actually been recently approached indirectly so far, but possibly will be directly by the administration of my hometown, Lviv. They want to make sure the Jewish life is prospering in Ukraine. My own grandfather was the editor of Lviv's Jewish newspaper for years. And I think what is important to do is remember the history, but also give a nation a chance to not overwrite that history, but to improve upon it and to change.
All right.
For
well,
the better.
Amy, thank you very much for the call. And Yulia, real interesting to hear your own family's connection to this. Wow. So let's take one more if we could. This is Elisa in Putney, Vermont. Hi, Elisa. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Fascinating issue. I have a stepmom who is Crimean. She's from Simferopol. She held high positions in the government in the former Soviet Union in tourism and culture. Her daughter and son-in-law are still there. They are overjoyed about the referendum and the annexation because for them it's an economic and cultural alignment that they have long missed since the breakup of the Soviet Union. So it's all very confusing for me because these are family members who are thrilled to have the possibility of their salaries doubling and to be reunited with their cultural brethren that they cannot relate to the Ukrainians whatsoever.
Well, so Alicia, I'm glad you called, and I'm sorry to cut you off because it's the end of this show, and I'm sorry about that. But this is really interesting, Laurent. Her stepmom's from Crimea. Her daughter in Crimea is overjoyed. I had read about Russian financial incentives for Crimeans to make their lives a little bit better economically given this reunion. Go ahead, Laurent, your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I think from the Ukrainian perspective here, the annexation by Russia actually doesn't make a lot of sense because Crimea is so dependent economically on the mainland for energy and fresh water, and then also for tourism. That's really the main economic activity in Crimea. They're really dependent on tourists coming from Russia, from Belarus, from Ukraine during the summer. And, you know, if things there are going to be unstable and dangerous, how are you going to have tourists going there? So the way Ukrainians look at this, they really, it doesn't make sense why some Crimeans want to actually join the Russian Federation economically.
It's interesting. Yeah, Al, I know you want to jump in.
Yeah, it's... Well, to me, it does make sense why many of those people in Crimea are sort of rooting towards Russia. It's strong historical ties with the Soviet Union heritage. It's the paternalist culture, if you will, because the motivation would be their pensions are larger, as you have heard just now, and their president is well respected by the world, and somewhere deep inside they might be still willing to have a strong czar.
The Crimeans. They like being linked to that. Some, obviously, we can't speak for everybody, but some obviously like that link to that strong guy, Putin.
Plus the very massive propaganda.
You know, all of you, we have to close it out. But Laurent, I wanted to ask you, what's your best case scenario for how all this ends up? And how likely do you think that scenario is, Laurent?
Well, I would really like to see some real sincere reforms made by a future Ukrainian government to really just improve people's lives, to get real democratic freedoms and institutions working in Ukraine, to improve the economy and people's situations. And that's really what the whole revolution and the protest movement was all about. You know, it's not, you know, East versus West in Ukraine. It's really just about rights and freedoms and a better life.
Well, Laurent, it's been great to talk to you. And stay safe there, okay?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Laurent Marshall, former member of the Peace Corps in Ukraine, now works and lives in Lviv. He's a graduate of Sauhegan High School in New Hampshire. Yulia Komska, good to have you as always. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Yulia Komska, assistant professor of German at Dartmouth College. Her first book, The Icon Curtain, The Cold War's Quiet Border, comes out at the end of the year. And Al Bamar, thank you for coming. We really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Laura.
Al Bamar, software engineering manager in Nashua. He's lived in New Hampshire since the late 90s. He's originally from eastern Ukraine. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow in The Exchange, weighing wind power in the Granite State. With controversy continuing over several major projects and debates at recent town meetings, there's also vigorous disagreement among environmentalists over wind's benefits. While some see it as a vital part of a clean energy future, others believe the impacts aren't worth it, from views to open space to animal habitat. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio with the Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the grand family of State Motors Lincoln. Welcoming the former Lincoln of Concord customers for all their automotive needs, State Motors Lincoln, exit 9 South off I-93, North Manchester. And the New Hampshire Moose License Plate Program, thanking drivers for supporting the Granite State's natural, historical, and cultural heritage. Information online at mooseplate.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
PR.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. One-third of the world's population is infected with tuberculosis. That means every time you take a subway, taxi, or board a plane, you could be coming into contact with TB. While the number of TB cases reported in the U.S. is on the